This is The Forgetting.
What I try to do now is to get me out of bed in the morning is to have a list, something where I have to talk to someone, I have to be there, I have a deadline. So the strategy of my life is not to give into that, but even if I'm writing something, I say, you have to have this written by 9 o'clock. So you better get your freaking ass out of bed. In the middle of the night, this was last week, I woke up, didn't know where I was. I fell out of bed. I was alone, fell on my head, and was knocked out for a bit. And it still hurts, and if my doctor is listening, he'll be really pissed at me, but I'm afraid to go get checked out again because I think in this disease you just don't want to know. Sometimes my wife is screaming at me saying, why don't you just let us help you? And sometimes that's what it takes to bring me back.
WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and also from my brownstone apartment in Brooklyn, New York, this is The Forgetting, a podcast about dementia. I'm David Shank, author of the book The Forgetting and senior advisor to an international research consortium called Cure Alzheimer's Fund, which helps make this podcast possible. And with me, as always, is my close friend and quite necessary co-host, Greg O'Brien, author of On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. His book has that subtitle because Greg has early onset Alzheimer's, and he is committed to reporting his experience for as long as he possibly can. That's why this podcast exists. Hi, Greg.
Hi, David. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you? It's been about 3 weeks since we spoke last.
Are you still smarter than me?
I don't know about that, but I guess we'll have our audience will be able to judge by the end of the hour. I don't think I ever was.
Well,
tell me what's going on in your life. How are you feeling today?
Well, I was supposed to meet someone today, right down the street from where I live, and I totally forgot where I was going, so I had to call them because I was late, and I'm getting these nasty texts, and I said, I'm sorry. I only lived in this town for 35 years and I can't freaking find you. So they were cool about it. But what, in terms of new things, which is cool, and this is not a plug because I always kid about Fox News always plugging their books, but I do have a revised edition coming out soon. And my wife, Mary Catherine, wrote a soul-searching chapter about what it's like to be a caregiver, and that's it was very enlightening to me because there were no holes barred in this. And one of her lines is, "What's a nice girl like me doing in a place like this?" And then my son Connor wrote about being kind of my day-to-day caregiver because my wife works, and my kids Brendan and Colleen are writing first person pieces, and I think Alzheimer's, one person doesn't just get it, the whole family gets it. And
right.
And it's kind of like the elephant in the room, and you've always been instrumental in telling me that, you know, my family should write about it, and they finally have. And you know, it's hit me hard, just like in writing Pluto. You know, you have to stand naked, and that's not fun, but at least you try to protect your family. And now my family wants to stay naked for the bigger cause. You know, as you know, I lost my grandfather, my mother, my father, and paternal uncle to this disease, and they're worried about themselves. And my daughter Colleen just had a baby girl, Adeline, and she's worried. And so they got to speak what's on their heart.
it's wonderful that they're writing about their experience, and I'm sure it doesn't come quite as naturally to them as it did to you, since you spent your whole life as a writer. What was it? Was it hard to convince them to do it? Was it hard to get them to actually write? What was that process like?
I think they knew that they should, and you've always encouraged that, and others encouraged it. And, you know, I think, you know, I'm sure there are people who are caregivers who are listening, and, you know, they're the heroes of the world. You know, people who have the disease like me, hey, we're going to forget, and they won't forget. I've had the unusual position of being a caregiver and now someone with the disease, because I was the family caregiver for my mother, and which I think is an important discussion on this disease, is that when you're in the throes of it, if you have the disease, you're just fighting and fighting, and many of us are fighting without really appreciating what the caregivers are doing, because they get sick, they get depression, you know, my wife draws the analogy of when the lights go off in my head to the old movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And she's got to put up with the rage and the yelling and the screaming. And I forget when I keep telling you stuff, so you tell me if I didn't tell you. But we were asked, and Mary Catherine was on a panel with me at WGBH in Boston, and there's a new documentary, which is incredible. Every minute counts. So I'm in the car, cab. We had to stay in Boston, which is great, at a hotel, and took a cab over. And Connor, Mary Catherine, and I are in the cab, and the cabbie took a wrong turn, and I'm supposed to be there. And I went into insulting rage, out-of-body rage, paranoia, that this cabbie was taking us, which is part of the disease. And I was yelling and screaming at Mary Catherine, four-letter words that I should have been turned into a pillar of salt. And then when we finally got there, Connor and Mary Catherine are apologizing to the cabbie, who, if he's listening, I'd like to apologize to him. I was just way out of line, and you
we'll try to get him on the podcast at some point.
Yeah, he's probably left the cab business, but I was so angry that I walked across a busy street in Boston to WGBH, and I didn't give a shit if I was, maybe I shan't say shit, can I say? I didn't give a
you
shit.
You can say whatever you want.
Okay. I didn't give a shit if I was hit by a car. And that's where this disease will take you, but you know, you could look at that and say, "Geez, that's a tough thing to go through." But what about my family? You know,
right?
What? You know, they got to deal with it, and it's brought us closer. In a funny sort of way, just like it was with my mom and dad who had Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's has begun to heal our marriage, and I know that sounds kind of funny, because we need each other, and, you know, started out like most marriages with the romance, and, you know, I probably shouldn't say this, but I will. The sex was really good, and then we had kids, and then we kind of go our own way, and it's not so good, because, you know, we're from different planets. And in this moment of Alzheimer's, as I noticed with my parents, our marriage is coming somewhat full circle, and Alzheimer's forces you to look within. And if you're a caregiver, you have to look within, and we're meeting each other more and more on the inside, not the outside. That probably doesn't make any sense, but.
No, it does. And there are a couple things I want to say. One is that we just crossed into an area that I never thought we'd get to in this particular podcast, which is sex. And I want to encourage you to.
I'm not going to have sex with you, David. So don't ask, don't tell.
Well, we're already very intimate with one another. We'll see where it goes.
Okay. If I
But
do,
no,
I'll forget, okay?
that what you say about I mean, I've seen that with your own family, and so what you're saying resonates with me because I've seen it in person. But it also resonates with me because it's been my observation and many others for many years that when families encounter, something as devastating as Alzheimer's, it either brings the worst out in you or brings out the best. And sometimes it's both, in coexisting. But I've seen families who, have siblings and parents and kids who have very fraught relationships, and this becomes the breaking point. This like trust and dependence, and it just the stress that comes in, it just drives, it ex explodes families
It
that are in difficult shape.
is a breaking point, and it's brought out the worst and the best in me, and the family has tried to relate to that, but it's getting back to my point, when one member of the family has Alzheimer's, every member of the family has it,
Right,
and in trying
right.
to solve and cure this disease, we need to understand how far-reaching it is. We need to understand that it could start 20 years before even symptoms are there, but there are
Right.
certain subtle things that people notice, and it affects in my case, David, I have the family history. I have the gene APOE4, mother and father, and two serious head injuries. And the other night, good example, I'm on Nantucket, and I had to be there to meet with someone and do some writing, and they have big beds over there in these old places. And in the middle of the night, this was last week, I woke up, didn't know where I was. I fell out of bed. I was alone, fell on my head, and was knocked out for a bit. And it still hurts, and if my doctor is listening, he'll be really pissed at me, but I'm afraid to go get checked out again, because I think in this disease you just don't want to know. And so you worry, is there a blood clot up there? Is it, you become more paranoid. And I know anyone with Alzheimer's listening, or family, they'll know what that is. You don't trust yourself. You go, oh my God, what's going to happen? And sometimes I've been fighting about this whole denial thing, but yet there are times when I myself live in denial, and it's a contradiction. And so all of this swirls around, and in my case, it's helping to heal my marriage, which is kind of a odd thing when you think about it, but it happened with my parents, and it's healing our family. And maybe that's one of the silver linings of Alzheimer's, if there is one.
Yeah, and I wanted to sneak this in because the other side of my point was that I've also seen this so often is where it can bring out the worst in families, as I said, but it can also really bring families together in a profound way, and as you say, it can be healing. And I've actually given lectures where I'm talking about the disease, the science of it. I'm explaining the stages of it. It's all bad. It's either you're talking about it clinically, or you're talking about it scientifically, or you're talking about how it affects the person or the caregiver, and it's nothing but bad news. And I've actually been interrupted in lectures by people who are going through this as a patient or as a family member, and saying, "When are you going to talk about the silver lining, about the nice things that happen as a result of this bad thing?" They won't let me get away without letting them or having me address the really surprising warmth and closeness that can come out of people responding to this challenge. And I didn't know your family before you were diagnosed, but I certainly have seen how remarkable all of you are together. I don't get to see the rough stuff.
Well,
Maybe you'll show me sometime, but
it is it's ugly, but it's all part of learning to live with this disease, which we're forced to. And I did write this thing down, a quote that Mary Catherine wrote in her new chapter in my book, and it's a quote from a British novelist, E.M. Forster, who once wrote, quote, and I'm reading this from the quote my wife gave me, "You must be willing to let go of the life we have planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us." Mm. And that's from my wife that she came upon that and said, "This sucks, Greg. What's a nice girl like me doing in a place like this? But I have to let go of the life that I had planned." So
that's amazing.
So that gets back to the healing of the marriage. I'm just a dumbass Irish prick. And now I have to say, holy shit, I need to soften up, you know?
And I wonder just kind of day to day, hour to hour in the home, do you feel, where you are right now in the disease and vis-a-vis your kids and your wife, do you feel that they treat you too? What I'm trying to say is, are they understanding enough of your disabilities, or are they too understanding? I mean, which side do they err on? Are they impatient that you can't do things, or do they sometimes assume you can't do things that you can do? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a good question for those, again, who listening who deal with this. It's a mix. It's a real mix. It depends on where they are in the moment. And sometimes they assume you can do it, and sometimes they assume you can't. Sometimes my wife is screaming at me saying, "Why don't you just let us help you?" And sometimes that's what it takes to bring me back and realize that I'm an independent sort. We all have different DNAs. And, you know, I probably my whole work life took off 4 or 5 days because I was sick. You know, I just played with the hurts. And I used to, when I played football in college, you know, I had two pulled groins once, and I taped myself with duct tape from the top of my knees to my chest, and I went out and played. That's dumb shit, but that's keeps me alive. And it's a terrible word picture, but
I really wish I didn't have that image in my mind, but
I
there
understand.
It is. Duct tape.
Yeah.
How'd you get it off? You're a hairy guy.
I know it. It really
hurt. It's not good.
It hurt. I had to rip that stuff. It hurt. You know.
You really wanted to play.
Yeah.
It really goes to the determination to get in that game, right?
Well, we played against Fordham and University, and they were that year, I think, were the number one small college team in the nation, and we lost 68-0, and. But I went out and played offense and defense and got my ass kicked.
I think I just got a new answer to just the question, just how determined is Greg O'Brien in his life? The story of duct taping your groin up to your chest for whatever reason.
And in that, you're kind of duct taping.
Yeah.
I don't want to worsen the word picture. You're kind of duct taping your privates too. And that's just not.
Yeah, no, I got it. I know what's in between
it's
there.
It's not comfortable.
I'm a guy.
It's not. And then ripping it off, it's like, oh my God. I thought my thing was going to fall off. But I'm sorry. Sean is shaking his head, so I'm probably getting. I should be careful.
Sean will have to deal with it. Sean, that's
he's
his
just
burden.
Writing down right now, I need to delete that. Too much information.
Well, when we stop recording, I'm gonna spend a few minutes begging Sean to leave that in, because that's that's the good stuff. That's what people want to hear.
You know, my wife has a sense of humor, and if I could read a short excerpt from, and then you could edit it out if it doesn't work, but.
Sure.
She's talking about Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And so she said, years ago, it got worse as Greg's mother drifted deeper into Alzheimer's and we became family caregivers. I saw firsthand the terrifying, disconnected, debilitating, hostile nature of this disease. Then to my horror, I began to see it in my husband, invasion of the body snatchers, as Greg calls the disease, slow at first, then a quickening pace. The explosion, rage, the drifting, the ceaseless short-term memory loss, absence of filter and judgment, balance at times, repeating himself, asking the same damn questions. I was out of my mind. I was in denial at first, thinking he was just becoming more of a perfect asshole. Greg has always sought perfection in his life. In time, the evidence was overwhelming, particularly after Greg's parents had died. He was no longer consumed with caring for him. He was privately consumed with fighting his own demons. And that's that. When, you know, when I read it, I cried. It told me, because we don't talk about it a lot, and maybe the spouses of caregivers don't talk about it a lot. But when I heard that, I said, "Wow, she's getting it," and it really made me realize more and more that the whole family has got a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and we really need to stand up for the caregivers and really care for them. So,
yeah. Amen. So what's next for you? What's the rest of your, what's your weekend look like? Do you plan things from, you know, in the future, or do you just take it, you know, hour to hour? What's your planning life like?
I work off lists that I change all the time, and it depends on the energy. I'm finding now, that I'm sleeping more and I don't want to get out of bed, which is something that a lot of people with the disease had told me. And so I've been fighting that. I won't take naps and stuff. And now what happens in the disease, and the doctors told me, is that and maybe we talked about this before, and Sean will be able to, but the doctors have told me that my immune system is in the toilet. I fight Alzheimer's. I fight prostate cancer. I have spinal stenosis and scoliosis, clinical depression, no feeling in parts of my feet and my legs. And they say, your body is winding down, and it's fighting stuff off, and your immune system is going, and you need to listen more to your body. And so, of course, I don't listen. And what I try to do now is to get me out of bed in the morning is to have a list, something where I have to talk to someone. I have to be there. I have a deadline. So the strategy of my life is not to give into that. But even if I'm writing something, I say, you have to have this written by 9 o'clock. So you better get your freaking ass out of bed. And then it's the discipline maybe of a writer that helps me. I go to the gym as much. I try to go every day, but I will not allow myself to go to the gym until I hit all the key things on my list.
What's your exercise regime now these days? I know you used to be a runner, but you had to stop doing that.
Yeah, I can't. I think we talked about this before, but
yeah,
I used to run. I'm 66, and when I was 62, I could run a 6-minute mile, and I did it out of rage in Alzheimer's, and now I'm in a lot of pain with the spinal stenosis and scoliosis. And you know, the doctors say that it's a combination of you know, damage you did to your body before, but also the progression of the disease, that the brain, they tell me, not only affects your thought, but it's the computer for the rest of your body, and it's stopping sending signals down, so it can't fight certain things, so things become more exasperated. And I won't take painkillers because it'll make me more loopy, and I refuse that. So I go to the gym and I put the treadmill up to an elevation of 15, and I crank it up to 6'2", and I do my miles that way. It's still painful, but it's less painful because I'm not pounding as much. And you know, just like in writing, these demons aren't going to tell me I can't write, and they're not going to tell me I can't run. Fuck them. Yeah.
I didn't realize that you'd given up running outside, but you're actually basically still running. You're just doing it on a treadmill.
Well, I can't run, so because it's too painful. So I'm putting the treadmill up. And
oh, I see. So it's walking. It's
a race walk.
It's walking uphill. Yeah.
Cranking. It's a race walk. Putting the treadmill at elevation of 15, cranking it up to 6.2, and sometimes a little higher, and then I'll spend a little time running, but most of it's race walking. But I don't have balance now, so I have to hold on to the treadmill, or I'd be like older people like me would understand this, like George Jetson in the Jetsons when he was on the treadmill and he got kicked off and Astro was chasing him. And it's a word picture that older people.
Yeah, no, that's happened to me twice. They've both been related to me listening to music and either trying to change something on the device or actually just closing my eyes and getting carried away with the music and forgetting for a second where I am. And then I let go and I do a George Jetson onto the floor.
Yeah, it happened once and I went into a wall, but the wall was padded. So, and everyone just, they were horrified. But I said, I just started laughing. I said, George Jetson. So,
yeah, it's scary. And how, but the reason for me asking you all this is that what I really want to know is how, can you describe how you feel right after? Like, do you feel like your thinking changes measurably? Is your, are you able to think clearer after a good workout?
Yeah. And this is so important. And Dr. Rudy Tanzi, who's a close mentor of mine, he's the top researcher at the Cure Alzheimer's Fund and a top doctor at Mass General, and he's told me to keep doing what I'm doing, to keep the fight, and to keep exercising my brain, and after I work out, I go write for 2 hours every night, just force myself, and he says that stubborn Irishness and that regimen of running and writing and the DNA that your mother had in fighting this disease, because she was on a similar path like me where she taught me how to do this. She wouldn't give in until she had to finally let go, which at some point I will. I've told Rudy that the day, and I wrote him an email about it, and I said, I don't want this to sound too harsh, but the day I can't write anymore is the day I'm checking out. And I think you know I'm not treating my cancer and other things because I think we're away from curing this disease. So I don't want anyone's pity, because if I have someone's pity, they're not going to listen to what I'm saying. And I'm fighting this in faith, hope, and humor, and living with it and trying to get others to do the same. That's just what I'm trying to do.
You know, you mention pretty frequently the idea of giving up at a certain time and checking out, and you have a couple other phrases. And I've never asked you if you actually have a plan. You know, a little pill somewhere or some other means to do this.
Okay, so I just answer it candidly, and then the police will be outside the door here and lock me up. But it's a horrifying disease, and I don't want to take my family, and we've talked about it, to that end stage. It's because I know what it looks like. And we face bankruptcy, but it'll be even worse, and the pain and the disconnection. I don't want to take my family there. So I have somewhat of an exit strategy with the cancer. But if you know, of course, I'm going to have a lot of splaining to do when I see God in heaven, but I feel what I'm doing now is what God wants me to do, to talk about this. So I just have a faith that God will find a way to take me out. However, if God is asleep at the wheel one day, I'm not allowed to be out on my boat, but I've thought about alone. I've thought about going out into the Atlantic and, you know, falling off. I'm being candid, okay? And I know all the other people say, oh my God, you know, you asked me the question. I'm not saying I'm doing it.
Right.
I'm saying,
right. No, I've
seriously thought about it, and shame on me if I don't answer a question candidly about the heart of this disease, because, you know, someone will see me in the gym and they'll say, oh, geez, he's a handsome guy, he looks good, you know. And I feel like saying, screw you. You have no idea what I'm going through. And it's like going up to, you know, it's like a person who's mute who might say, do I look like I'm deaf? You know, it's like digging below the surface. And that's a tough place to be. So I don't want to take my family there. And it's a tough thing, you know, end of life. We're talking about it around the country. And I have told people, and I've written about it, that when my time is done, and you know, I had a big argument with God the other day, and he says, you know, I felt he was saying, I got you right where I want you, and we got some stuff to do. And I keep saying, won't you take me home? Can I go home? And I want my family to be ready and cared for, and my wife. I often joke about Mary Catherine is a Jennifer Aniston lookalike, and so it'll be like Field of Dreams with guys lining up. So I don't worry so much about that, but I worry about my kids. And
right.
I don't know. Maybe I'm too candid here, but you asked me, and that's
no, that's not that. No, that that's. I knew I'd get a candid answer, and that's why I asked the question. I knew you wouldn't mind me asking either. So,
you're still not going to take the duct tape off my body. That's all.
But I just have one more little follow up to that topic, which is that it sounds like, from the way you're describing it, that you think of it much more in terms of as a gift to your family and not burdening them than you do in terms of giving yourself peace. Is that right?
It's a combination. Mm-hmm. I'm getting to the point where, to me, if I'm going to do this in terms of the fight, I have to do it at full tilt. And some people with cancer and some people with Alzheimer's can get taken out earlier. And some people with cancer and Alzheimer's, it's a longer journey. I think, as I told you before, if I knew why, I could tell you how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But I have a strong faith. I'm not proselytizing to anyone here, but this is the DNA I've been given. And we're part of the baby boom generation that, you know, we first lived by the rules, and we broke the rules and made new rules, and we're idealistic. And look at all the crap that's going on in the world today. And why don't we all try to do some good things on the way out and hold hands while we do it? And that's driving me. I'll say something I probably said before, but I'm no altar boy, even though I was when I was a kid. Most imperfect guy in the world, I've committed every sin a man can commit other than murder and adultery, and I've been tested in both. So I'm just a guy, okay? I'm in this place, and why don't I just keep fighting while I can? But when I can't communicate or get to that point or put my hands on the keys and know where the keys are, which is starting to happen now, there are other things in my life that have slipped, and you could tell by reading from Mary Catherine's excerpt, it's ugly. But when the essence of who I am as a person goes, I'm going, because I believe that the heart, the soul, I've learned to write from the heart and speak from the heart and write from the soul, because I don't trust my head anymore. But when that goes, I'm going, and I believe my soul, like everyone else's soul, lives on forever.
Well, I hope that's a long time from now. And We're going to wrap up our show now, but I do want to tell you that I do plan in future episodes to ask you about all those sins that you've committed.
Okay.
Because it sounds like there are a lot of good stories back there that we haven't gotten to.
You'd be like the Catholic priest, even though you're Jewish. It'll be, I'll say, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned." And then
it'll be the first podcast confession. Secular confession, we'll break some new ground there.
Well, I know we don't have time for this, but when I was a kid, we'd all get nervous at resurrection and queue up to do the confession thing. And I remember I was in there, there was Monsignor O'Brien who could tell by my voice who I was, and all these kids are lined up outside, and I confess my sins, and all of a sudden he yells out, "You what?" So then I had to walk out, and all these kids are looking at me. I don't remember what I did, but I have a funny thing about, I'd rather go just to God, but "You what?" And I go, "Oh shit." And they're all looking at me like, "What did you do? What did you do?" And some of the kids are like high-fiving me. They're thinking, "Well, he's pretty cool. Like, just thought he was a geek, you know, student, and wow, he's a regular guy, you know?"
All right. Well, we'll delve more into that another time. That is it for our show today. At WCAI in Woods Hole, the engineer has been Dan Tridle. Thank you so much, Dan, as always. Forgetting is a production of WCAI. Our producer is the great Sean Corcoran. Our theme music was composed and produced by Dr. Rudy Tanzi, who you were hearing about a few minutes ago, my friend and colleague, and Greg's friend and colleague, who is also chair of the Research Consortium at Cure Alzheimer's Fund. Thank you, Rudy, as always. And Greg, you still owe me $100.
I'm going to fax it from here.
All right, I'm waiting for it.
All right. Love you, man. I have to go to confession now.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay.
Talk to you soon.
See you. Take care.